You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're the parent of a teenager or a preteen, then you may be all too familiar with what I'm about to describe. Your child, who used to be affectionate, well-behaved, outgoing, no longer wants to be seen with you in public, spends a lot more time in his or her room, maybe starts to act out in school. Normal teen rebellion, sounds like it, right? Well, it could be something more serious. That's the question many parents struggle with, and for more parents than you might imagine, the answer turns out to be a mental illness. As many as 1 in 10 children and teens suffers from a mental illness. But as we'll hear about for the rest of this hour, the healthcare system, from insurance companies to physicians, is often ill-prepared to help these children and their parents. We're going to hear the story of one parent's battle to get his kids properly diagnosed and treated, and we'll talk about the warning signs for mental illness and about the current debate over whether drugs used to treat depression in children may actually make them more suicidal. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at Science Friday. And please remember, as usual, when we talk about health issues, we can't really diagnose or provide detailed medical advice for a specific case. It's not ethical for us to do that and for, you know, to ask our doctors about you. We'll answer general questions in general and be happy to do that. And let me introduce my guests. David Fassler, MD, is the author of Help Me, I'm Sad, Recognizing, Treating, and Preventing Childhood and Adolescent Depression, published by Viking Penguin in 1997. He's a clinical director of Otter Creek Associates and a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont in Burlington. He joins us today from Lansdowne, Virginia. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fassler.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Paul Rayburn is a former writer and editor at Business Week, the author of Acquainted with the Night, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disorder in His Children, out this year from Broadway Books in New York, and he joins us from the campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Let's talk about childhood depression and experiences that people have had. And Paul, in your book, it's a heart-wrenching book. I have to say, in reading your experiences, you start out right with a bang with a story of your son Alex and an accident at school that led to his first hospitalization. Tell us about that. Had there been warning signs up to that point? Tell us what happened and what your experience was.
Well, there had been some signs. There had been some problems. Of course, Alex was the second child I had who entered the teenage years, so it's hard to know what's normal and what's not. But through the fourth and fifth grades, Alex had some problems with behavior at school, some emotional outbursts in the classroom, and so forth. It seemed to me to be pretty normal stuff, and in fact, I thought he was kind of a feisty kid. And,
right.
And in a certain part of me, I thought, well, it's good. He's independent. He's strong. These are good things, you know. In the fifth grade, however, the episode that I used to begin the book, he had one outburst in the classroom and a really angry outburst, stormed through the halls of the school, actually put his fist through the glass front of a large wall clock, and stormed out of the school, and the school officials, including a very stern principal, could not get him back inside. And at that time, they had to call the police, and a couple of police had to chase him down and get him into a police car, get him to the station where they were able to calm him down. So at that point, it was very clear that this was not normal behavior for a fifth grader, but it really came on suddenly, because before that day, it seemed like it was.
So now he was now basically in the mental health system. He's now in the system, as they say.
And in the system.
And it took years for you to get a proper diagnosis.
Absolutely. It was at least about 3 years before we got the right diagnosis and the right treatment. But the problems with the healthcare system, which I can't say enough about how poorly our system responds to kids like Alex. The only thing the police could do at that point was take him to the local county hospital for kids with psychiatric problems. The hospital had just been the focus of a series in the local newspaper of increased number of suicides, all kinds of supervision problems at the hospital, and so we had to really scramble to get him to a private hospital where he was admitted that night and then begin the long, complicated insurance story and the long, complicated story of trying to get a diagnosis. You know, the short story for the first chapter was he spent a week in the hospital, felt better, left, no diagnosis, no clue really as to what to do.
And the first thing they do is throw drugs at you.
That's right. He was given a given a drug that's good for both seizures and for some psychiatric ailments, because they didn't even know if it was really a psychiatric thing or a neurological thing. So they said, "Well, we'll give him this drug. Maybe that'll help whatever it is." Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Paul's story really illustrates a number of important points. First of all, these are not easy diagnoses to make, and as in his son's story, they often present in ways that you might not expect. So some kids certainly have a lot of signs and symptoms of what we think of classically as depression. They may be sad, they may be withdrawn, they may feel hopeless, but other kids go in an opposite direction. They may get irritable, they may be fighting, they may have trouble concentrating, and they may get angry, like happened with Paul's son. And also, his story demonstrates how hard it is to get good help and how important it is to get an accurate diagnosis, and how critical it is that parents are really advocates for their kids and that they keep pushing until they get to the right person, and there are no magic answers, and nobody has all the solutions, but you got to keep pushing, get to someone who really has the right experience and training and expertise, and who can help you find a solution for your particular child.
Paul, how old was your son when all this happened?
So it was fifth grade, so he was 11 at the time.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just at that time, just as you said in introducing the segment, that, you know, kids are changing, a lot of things are happening, so it was just tough to tell.
Could you, from what you know now, could you have picked up signs earlier when he was preteen, or you know, maybe in fifth grade, or 5 years old, six, seven? Could signs show up that early if you knew what to look for?
As I look back on Alex now, I don't see those things. But in the fourth grade, about a year before this happened, then there's kind of a gray period in there. And as I look back on that, I think now maybe that would have been a good time to get him in to see somebody, and maybe we could have intervened before the crisis.
Dr. Fassler, is there a time in a child's development where you can, maybe is it the fifth grade, you can start to pick up these signs, and what do you look for?
You know, we really see psychiatric problems throughout childhood and adolescence. It's certainly true that the incidence or the frequency increases as kids get older. You know, in your opening comments, you said that there's a 1 in 10 child. Actually, the Surgeon General's report would say that it's as high as 1 in 5 kids who actually have signs and symptoms of a significant psychiatric problem. And those signs include things like kids are feeling sad, they're having trouble sleeping, they feel hopeless or helpless. You may see significant changes in their behavior, problems sleeping, loss of appetite or energy. They're not interested in things that used to be fun. And it is hard for parents to tell, particularly, I think, around adolescence. There are lots of questions. Is this just a phase that a child's going through? Are they going to get through it? So what I suggest to parents is you really look at three things. The duration, are these signs and symptoms lasting? So it's not just something that's there for a weekend or a couple of days. Does it represent a change for your particular child? And most important, is it interfering with the child's life, either at home, in school, or with their friends? And clearly, with Paul's son, it was interfering with things at school, and I know also at home from his book. And so if you have symptoms that are lasting, it's new for a child, and they're interfering, get it checked out. If a child had a headache that wasn't going away for 2 weeks, we wouldn't think twice about getting it evaluated. Or if they come home from summer camp and they're limping, we bring them to a pediatrician. And mental health problems really are not different. These are very real illnesses, but the good news is that they're also quite treatable.
Now, Paul, your son was diagnosed with a case of bipolar disorder, correct?
Ultimately. After the long process, right?
But then your younger daughter, Alicia, was also diagnosed as suffering from depression.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. At about the same age, he was actually in the sixth grade, and we discovered just by chance that she had twice tried to commit suicide, once taking a handful of Advil and the other time Tylenol. And, I mean, this was an incredible shock. You know, when Alex was sick, I kept thinking to myself, thank goodness my other two kids are doing well because this has taken up all the energy I have. And mm-hmm. that's part of the problem, too. It's easy to let that happen and to forget about the healthy, you know, brothers and sisters. But right. So and then we discovered that she'd also been cutting herself on her upper arms using a razor blade. One of these strange behaviors that gives me a chill when I think about it. But for some kids and adults too, I guess, but many teenage girls in particular, that cutting is a way to kind of relieve the stress and anxiety and emotional pain they're going through. So, you know, we didn't discover right. this till it's been going on for some time.
Dr. Fassler, is this a symptom, a very well-known symptom?
Definitely, and we're actually seeing more of this kind of cutting behavior in kids, and I would say clearly all kids who are engaging in cutting or other self-destructive behavior, or certainly kids who are talking about hurting themselves or hurting somebody else, they all need a comprehensive mental health evaluation as quickly as possible. You know, just in terms of suicide, even among kids, suicide is the third leading cause of death among kids between age 15 and 24. And even among yeah. the younger kids, 5 to 14, it's the sixth leading cause of death. So we really, when kids are thinking about suicide, talking about suicide, making attempts, we need to take it extremely seriously.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can mix in some phone calls here. Phil in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Phil.
Yes, sir. Hi, how you doing?
Fine, go ahead.
My question is there any indication that there might be a relationship between children of that age that are on medication for ADD at school, whether that might mask those kind of symptoms or that might actually mimic those kind of symptoms?
It's a good question, and there's a significant overlap. You know, as many as half of all the kids who have depression have signs and symptoms of a second psychiatric illness, and about a quarter of the kids who have depression actually do have ADHD. But you're also correct that ADHD includes trouble paying attention, increased agitation, and that can also be signs of depression. So, or bipolar disorder. We think that as many as 30 to 40% of kids who actually have bipolar disorder get misdiagnosed with ADHD, and they may wind up on medicine for ADHD, and they're not getting better.
Thanks for calling,
yeah.
Phil.
Thank you.
One of the experiences with Alex was that he, one of the mistreatments was he was diagnosed with ADHD and given Ritalin, and for a kid with bipolar disorder, that threw him into a very manic episode mm-hmm. and landed him back in the hospital again. So they can not only be unhelpful sometimes, but
that's
harmful
right.
if the wrong one is given.
What are the state of your kids now?
I'm glad you asked that because I like to make sure to get that in every time I tell this story. Alex is now 19. He's just finished his first year away at college. He's getting great treatment. He's doing really well. He's not only doing well, but, you know, in some sense, if you can allow a little parental pride here, having been through this experience, I think he's wiser and more thoughtful kid than a lot of kids are at that age. And the same thing I think is true with Alicia. She's now 17, just finished her junior year in high school. She's getting terrific grades. She's headed for college. And these are outcomes, you know, that parents who are going through this now with their kids several years ago, I never would have expected we'd be in this situation now with the kids mm-hmm. doing great in school and with a very bright future. So it's worth saying to parents, hang in there if you're in the dark days of dealing with this, because in many, many cases, as Dr. Fassler says, there are good treatments and kids really do get better.
We're talking about childhood depression this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And Paul, what do you attribute the good outcome to?
Well, it's a little different in both cases. In Alex's case, I'm a little sorry to have to report that I found him a really good psychiatrist at Columbia University in New York through my professional connections as a reporter and writer. If I hadn't had those connections, I'm not sure he'd still be getting the right treatment now. And, of course, most people don't have those kinds of connections. In addition to that, I had to pay for most of that care out of pocket, which was a very, very steep bill, considerably more than the mortgage on my house for a long time.
Wow.
And most people aren't able to do that either. So I'm not trying to say that, you know, that I'm lucky because I had some options other people don't. The point is, you know, I did have some options. I took advantage of them for my kids. But the system is so broken that even somebody like me who has advantages has real trouble getting help. Most people don't have those, and they're really in hard shape.
And, Ira, I agree with Paul. It's a challenge, and you do need to keep pushing. And the first time you call your insurance company and they give you a list of names, doesn't mean that those are the right names for your child. Mm-hmm. And you can talk to your pediatrician, talk to your friends, talk to the principal or the guidance counselor at school, but keep pushing until you get to a mental health professional, psychiatrist, and or other clinicians who are right for your child.
And you have to do a lot of homework on your own, don't you, Paul?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. You know, I the reason I initially got involved in writing the book was I was trying to do the research and the reporting to try to learn how to help my kids. And pretty soon I realized there were so many other people who needed the same kind of help. And then I decided I'd write about it.
And I would recommend Paul's book to parents who are going through this because it really shows how you can work yourself through the maze and keep pushing. And it also demonstrates that you really have to become very knowledgeable and informed about the system and about these disorders in order to get the best care for your kids.
Talking with Dr. David Fassler, author of Help Me, I'm Sad, Recognizing, Treating, and Preventing Childhood and Adolescent Depression, co-authored with Lynn Dumas and Paul Rayburn, Acquainted with the Night, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disorder in His Children. Let's see if we can get a quick question in before we have to go to the break. Loretta in Oregon. Hi, Loretta. Quickly.
Hi. Thank you very much. One of the questions I have is when a 9-year-old talks about death in the sense expresses hopeless thoughts like, I don't want to live. I mean, how do you know that that's, when do you take it seriously and when do you say this is just wanting attention?
David Fassler?
Yeah, Loretta, I would say that as a parent, you should never have to make that decision. Any child who's thinking about death, talking about death, feeling hopeless, get it checked out. Get to a trained and qualified mental health professional and get a full evaluation.
Do you know where to find one, Loretta? Okay. Well, where do you find one, Dr. Fassler?
I would start by talking to a child's pediatrician. Mm-hmm. Again, talk to people at school, talk to people in the neighborhood. If you're near a university, call the university, ask for the psychiatry department, ask if they have a child psychiatry department, look at the local community mental health centers. Mm-hmm. But keep pushing till you get to a good person, at least for a comprehensive evaluation.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Paul Rayburn and David Fassler and take your questions about mental health for your kids. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about mental illness in children with my guest, Paul Rayburn, who is author of Acquainted with the Night, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disorder in His Children, out this year from Broadway Books. David Fassler, Dr. Fassler's author of Help Me, I'm Sad, Recognizing, Treating, and Preventing Childhood and Adolescent Depression, a Viking book. It's still out, Dr. Fassler, is it not?
Yes, it is.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. If you're having, Paul, when you were going through this with your kids, you spent, it took a toll on your family, did it not, and your marriage?
It did, yeah. The marriage was collapsing before the kids got sick, but we were divorced during the worst of the crisis years, which didn't help matters. And, you know, it was a very difficult time in a lot of ways. One of the things, when Dr. Fassler said earlier, you know, the sort of three or four things that parents might look for to recognize these illnesses in their kids, you know, if I'd known him at the time and he'd said that to me, I would have said, come on, you know, not my kids. My kids don't have these problems. And, you know, there was a long period that I went through of just denying that this could be possible. And again, it was one of the things I really highlighted in the book because I wanted other parents to know. I think a lot of us make a lot of mistakes as parents trying to deal with these things. And, you know, I deeply regret a lot of the things I did with the kids, getting angry, essentially, many times when they were sick and deserved support, not anger. And I think, you know, other parents, I think, do that too. And partly what I wanted to convey was that, you know, that's okay. You know,
right.
we come to recognize these things in our time, and that's the best we can do. And we can't ask more of ourselves than that.
Was there a moment of epiphany you had when you said, you know, this isn't just a lazy kid. This isn't someone who's an underachiever. I'm doing this all wrong.
Yeah, I think it came to me not quite in a moment, but I think somewhere, you know, after Alex had been in the hospital, I began to realize that this denial had a lot more to do with me than
right.
the objective facts
right.
of what were going on.
And you spent a lot of time and effort in this. Was there a point where you might have said, I wish there was some place I might have sent my child to get dedicated full-time help?
Absolutely. And Alicia did spend about 7 or 8 months in a therapeutic school. The problem is what you look for with kids like these who are sick but intelligent and in other ways perfectly normal kids is, you know, good school, a supportive environment, some therapy and medication, the kinds of things they need for their illness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very difficult to find that. In the cases where my kids spent extended periods of time away from the public school, they were in places with kids with multiple problems, full of learning disabilities and so forth. The schooling was essentially nil. So they were getting good care for their
right.
illnesses, but not good school. And from talking to lots of other parents, it's very hard to find good school and good care in one institution. I don't think we have those places.
Dr. Fassler, is there a place like that? Are there places?
Well, there are certainly programs around the country. Some of them are specialized for particular kinds of problems. I think Paul is correct. It's hard to find a place that's good for all kinds of things. We have a program in Vermont, which is an alternative school that we helped set up where kids can be there for a year and really focus on both education and behavior. We have a program in Boston, an inpatient program for kids with eating disorders, which is another kind of problem that we're seeing much more frequently these days. But it is a challenge to match the child and the child's needs to the particular kind of problem. I did want to make a comment about some of the family issues that Paul raised. I know he says he deeply regrets some of the things he did, but I think it's important for parents to realize that these kinds of problems, depression and bipolar disorder, aren't their fault. At least I, as a psychiatrist, don't believe that parents cause these problems. I think most clinicians at this point feel that these kinds of illnesses do have a biological base, that kids are born with a certain kind of genetic predisposition to have these kinds of problems. And certainly what happens in your life can increase or decrease the likelihood that you actually get depression or bipolar disorder, but it really isn't, at least I don't think it's a parent's fault that kids have these kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Talking
yeah,
with...
I'd,
go ahead.
I'd agree with that what we need to do is, you know, help parents, not blame parents, and it's hard for parents to find help. That's another thing. The child psychiatrist, if you're involved with one, takes care of the child. There's not really anybody to take care of the parents.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Paul Rayburn, author of Acquainted with the Night, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disorder in His Children, and Dr. David Fassler, author with Lynn Dumas of Help Me, I'm Sad, Recognizing, Treating, and Preventing Childhood and Adolescent Depression. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Go to the phones. Dave in Tallahassee. Hi, Dave.
Hey.
Hi there.
I'm a teenager, just got out of my first year of college. And after witnessing my friends have problems with depression and things, I've noticed that the major theme seems to be sort of a detachment from reality. And the way that they sort of regain their sort of feeling of control or try to exercise it is either cutting themselves or hurting themselves or trying to end their own lives, just as sort of like grasping on to their last little bit of reality in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Passler?
I think that's a very good comment, and it's actually something that we are seeing in teenagers and college students. You know, there are more and more kids with serious psychiatric problems on college campuses, and more of the colleges are realizing this and increasing the resources so that kids can get the help that they need. We are seeing more detachment. One of the questions we get asked often is there more mental illness today than there used to be? And I think it's a combination. I think we're getting better at recognizing the signs and symptoms. But in the kids, it does seem that they've lost some of the things that used to be protective factors, like being more connected to their communities or to extended families. And there certainly are, there do seem to be more kids who seem detached and like they don't have connections.
Another piece of that as well is the heavy alcohol and drug use kids in high school and college, where I think in many cases they're reaching for something. They're in some emotional pain and not getting the right help, so they turn to those things as alternatives, and that certainly makes things worse.
Paul, you mentioned before, and you said, I think, something very interesting, that when you talk about this, you do want to point out that your outcome, though it took years of hard work and anguish on everybody's part, has been very positive with your kids.
And that's right.
And if you work hard enough at it and you find the right combination, it can work.
That's right. It takes a lot of energy. I think it probably takes a little bit of luck. But as Dr. Fassler says, you just push and push and push. And if you can't get the right help from the people on your insurance company or the people in your community, go to the nearest big city medical center. You really need to pull out all the stops.
And Ira, I think that's the take-home message for parents, that you know, these are very real illnesses. They affect a lot of kids. But the good news is that we really can help most of these kids. And I'll tell you, as a child psychiatrist, we can't cure everything, but we can significantly reduce the extent to which the problems interfere with the kids' lives.
Now, Paul was talking about taking about 3 years to find the right medication for him, the right combination. Dr. Fassler, why is that? Why is it so long? And why do you see some cases where children get worse because they're getting the wrong stuff?
Well, again, these are not easy diagnoses to make. So first of all, you have to have the right diagnosis. And in Paul's story, it took quite a while to get to the right diagnosis. And then we really need a lot more research in this area. We have some studies and some good research that helps point us in the right direction. But each child is different, and what works for one child really won't necessarily work for another child, which is, again, why it's important to get to someone who you like and trust and who your child can work with, so that you can try a number of different things until you find a combination that works.
But you also talk about the physician. In your book, you say the use of these drugs in kids is a highly unregulated and potentially dangerous experiment.
That's in Paul's book, I hope.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Paul, I'm sorry. Okay. Paul, I looked at the wrong book.
Yeah, I'll stand behind those words.
Okay.
Yeah, two or three weeks ago, there was a story broke, the first government study that showed that Prozac was effective in kids.
Right.
Now, that's great news, but it's 2004. Prozac's been around for, 20 years or longer, and we're just now finding out that it's effective in kids. You know, all we've had to go on before is drug company studies, and you briefly mentioned before there's considerable concern now that maybe these antidepressants, there have been questions raised about whether they might pose some risks in kids, questions about suicide. It looks like that's a very small risk, and I'm sure Dr. Fassler will want to jump in and say parents should not take their kids off these medicines because of that concern. They should talk to their kids' doctors about it. But we really know very little about how these things work in kids,
and I think,
you know, that's a scandal.
Paul and I really agree about that. There, in this country, we have over a million kids on SSRI antidepressants now, and he's correct. Actually, the study that came out recently, it was a little more narrow. It wasn't even about younger children. It was just about adolescents. We have even less really good research when it comes to younger children. So we clearly need more studies. Paul is correct. I've actually looked at the suicide data. I testified at the FDA back in February. That question is still open. There are an independent group of researchers at Columbia University who are reanalyzing all the data, and hopefully within the next couple of months we'll have a more definitive scientific answer on that important issue. But
let me just interrupt, because I have to give a little message here to tell everybody. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Go ahead, David
Fast. Just to finish on the medication, in my opinion, medication can be extremely helpful and even life-saving for some kids, but medication alone is almost never an appropriate intervention for these kinds of complex child psychiatric disorders. And as Paul knows, most of these medications are not actually prescribed by child psychiatrists. They're prescribed by pediatricians and primary care providers. So again, it's important to get to someone who can really do a good evaluation and at least get you started in the right direction with medication if medication is going to be a part of the treatment plan for your child. And it's also important to know that there are a lot of kids who can and do get better without medication. Probably half of the kids with depression can be effectively treated without medication. So people shouldn't necessarily think that if I go for an evaluation, it automatically means medication.
But isn't the trend in psychiatry these days to use drugs?
Well, you know, with all the new research, I think we're reevaluating some of what we're doing. We should use medication when it's indicated and when it's appropriate and when it can be helpful. But there are a lot of kids, particularly younger kids, who can be treated quite effectively with other kinds of intervention. I actually think all kids with depression deserve and benefit from individual therapy, counseling. I think almost all families benefit from family support, family therapy. As Paul's story points out, if you have a child with depression, it affects everybody in the family. Often we have to work with the school because, as again in Paul's case, there have been a lot of issues and problems in school. So you really, the best chance for a positive outcome is a comprehensive treatment plan that's individualized to the needs of the child and the family.
Mm-hmm. So, Paul, was there a healing process that had to go on here once you know this turmoil went through?
I think we're still in that process, and also because of the divorce that happened at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm rebuilding my relationships with my kids in a lot of ways, and but you know they're becoming adults now, and I look forward to many happy years in that rebuilding mm-hmm. program. Actually,
do you feel like the burden is now on their shoulders to take over where you were?
Well, I think you know more
that?
And more yeah. They do. And Alex, you know, Alex is 19. He's very responsible about taking his medication and right. understands because there are times when he hasn't, and he knows he doesn't feel good. Alicia is a little younger, but I think she's moving in that direction too. And you know, that's what they'll have to do. And they're terrific kids. You know, I've written about all the problems they've been through and everything we've been through as a family. You'd never know it if you met them.
And they agreed to allow you to tell their story.
They did.
Yeah. I want to thank both of you for taking time to talk with us. David Fassler is author of Help Me, I'm Sad, Recognizing, Treating, and Preventing Childhood and Adolescent Depression, out by Viking Penguin. It's a Penguin book published in 1997, still available. He's a clinical director at the Otter Creek Associates and Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Vermont in Burlington. Paul Rayburn is author of Acquainted with the Night, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disorder in His Children, out this year by Broadway Books in New York. Thank you both for taking time to talk with us, and good luck to you.
Thanks a lot, Ira.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Rigo Cardi and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn, engineer Russ White in East Lansing, and Doug Patterson in Seattle. Surf over to our website if you missed any of the links we talk about. You wanted to know more about the books. They're up there. Also, Science Friday has back editions on Real Audio, and you can download them on your Audible.com player. Have a great week. We'll see you next weekend. Well, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.